Hello and welcome to episode 12 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name's Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Scandal for Computer Weekly in 2009.
Which I have saved as a bookmark on my web browser. Can you remember,
and this is,
I was looking at it the other day, can you remember what your investigation was actually called?
I remember it finished with Postmasters Tell Their Story.
It does. Bankruptcy, prosecution and disrupted livelihoods, Postmasters Tell Their Story. Can you remember what date it was in 2009?
It was in May.
Yes, it's like a test, this, isn't it? It was the 11th of May, Rebecca Thompson, and it's got your name attached to it, but we don't have a byline photo. As I say, I was looking at it the other day.
Well,
hello,
that's
everyone.
That's good.
That's good, is it? I don't know. I think you photographed very well. Hello, everyone. My name is Nick Wallace. I wrote the book called The Great Post Office Scandal in 2021.
But can you remember the subtitle for that?
The fight to expose a multi-million pound IT disaster which put innocent people in jail, I think.
Impressive. Very impressive.
If it's right.
I don't actually know if that's right because I don't
hang
keep
on.
A,
well, I've
a
got
copy
the book
next to me.
Well,
all
funnily
times.
Enough, funnily enough, because I'm doing a talk this evening, I do actually have a copy of the book in my bag.
What a shocker.
Yeah, exactly. Just in case, you know, just in case anyone
with
wants
a framed
to buy one.
Photo
in anyone,
yourself.
If anyone stops me and wants to buy a copy of the book, The Fight to Expose a Multi-Million Pound IT Disaster Which Put Innocent People in Jail. I think that's
very good.
100%. 5 out of 5. Well done, me. Right, let's concentrate on the job in hand.
Ah, but can you remember, more importantly, who you interviewed for this podcast?
Yes, I can. Her name is Deirdre Connolly, and she is a former sub-postmaster from Killiter in County Tyrone, Northern Ireland. This interview, I suppose, could be seen as a companion piece to the article that I put up on my website, postofficescandal.uk, last week, which is called The Compensation Catch. Deirdre is one of the 555 civil litigants who the government decided back in March they would give proper compensation to, and then announced a £19.5 million interim compensation fund, which they said would be doled out within a matter of weeks. We are now in September. And a couple of weeks back, Deirdre contacted me in some distress after getting an email from the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance, essentially saying that it didn't look likely that she was going to get any interim compensation this year because she was a complex case. Now, I did a bit of digging and wrote the article, The Compensation Catch, and then I thought, as I didn't actually get a chance to put Deirdre's story in my book, I'd see if she wanted to do a podcast to talk about what led to her being one of the 555 and her whole situation. And she very kindly said yes. Now, Deirdre is a very, very dear person to me. I met her and her family when they came over for the trial back in 2018, and they're an absolutely wonderful bunch. But she has been through the mill. Her story is fascinating. Deirdre, hello. Can you hear me, first of all?
Yes, can, yeah.
Great. Okay, I can hear you. That's the start. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I don't really have a planned structure for talking to you. I just feel that I've never properly spoken to you about everything that happened. And given that you are one of the people still waiting for anything like some indication as to when you're going to get proper compensation, it struck me as being quite a good idea to have a chat and see where your head's at now and see how everything is. I think we'd better, first of all, talk about how we met and where we met, because that was whilst the group litigation was going on back in 2018. And I don't know whether it was the first time you came over or the second time, but I think you and your family had to sit through possibly the driest day of legal argument that I think I've ever heard in my entire life. Was that the first time you came over?
That was
over
the first time, yeah.
Right, so tell me what your plans were for coming over, why you decided to come to London and what your thinking was behind it.
We just wanted to be part or see what was going on. Being over here in Northern Ireland, you feel you're missing out on things. You don't hear anything. We seem to be just in a wee bubble over here. We don't hear any information, won't get any information. So we said we decided we'd go over. But that time there was very little come out of that trial.
I felt so
that day.
Well, I felt. I mean, that's the thing, because I'd been sitting through every day and there had been incredible days of evidence. And I felt so sorry for you, the fact that you'd flown over and you had to sit through a day, I think, of Patrick Green, the claimant's QC, basically taking the judge through what they call the authorities, which is
yeah.
all the legal precedents that allow him to make his argument for the current case that he was making. And, you know, I've sat through pretty tedious days in court before, but that one is still, I think, the worst that I've had to sit through.
It was still good to be there and to see the setup.
Yeah. Because what did you know? Because when did you sign up? When did you become a claimant in the group litigation?
I went through the mediation process as well. So I was.
Oh, did you?
There was 150 of us, and I was M150.
Right.
I was 100.
So you were the last one. Last one through the gate.
Yeah.
And how did you hear about mediation? Was that through the JFSA, or did you hear about it?
Through Alan Bates and JFSA.
So how did you sign up with him?
My sister-in-law, Kate, saw something was advertised, and I don't know if it was a paper or where, and she cut it out and gave it to Darius, my husband, and she says it might be worth phoning. So I thought about it, and I remember making that phone call to Alan Bates, and Alan went through, listened to my story, and at the end of the conversation, he said to me, he says, bet you were told you were the only one. And I went, I was. And he says, Deirdre, we'll look after you from here on in. And that's, I remember that conversation. That's the first time.
Can you remember what year that was? Because you lost your post office in 2010.
10, yeah.
And the mediation scheme started in 2013. So can you remember around when you would have spoken to Alan?
Can't remember,
but you were on his list, and you got into the mediation scheme.
Yeah,
can you remember what that period was like? Because this, I mean, I made a lot of the mediation scheme in my book, and obviously I was aware of the story whilst it was happening, and it was a big deal at the time, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. I just remember, I just went with the flow, to be honest. When Alan sent emails, I listened to them, and then I was offered mediation over here. But at that stage, JFSA was coming out of the mediation.
Right.
Because the post office weren't mediating anyway.
I mean, obviously your relationship with the post office changed irrevocably after 2010. Did you have any faith in them when this mediation scheme came up? Did you get a sense from what you were hearing that this might be some kind of resolution?
Nope, definitely not.
And of course, you were going through your own troubles.
Yeah.
Because you were declared bankrupt that year, weren't you?
Yeah.
So 2013, 2014.
That was all just a build up, but I took epilepsy as well in 2013.
Yeah.
So it was, we went bankrupt on the February, 22nd of February, and we were bankrupt I took epilepsy in May. That same year.
And then, the scheme was announced in the August, wasn't it, the same year? Mm. Just for people who aren't familiar with your story, and I've seen your evidence to the Post Office Horizon Inquiry, and I've read your witness statement, and obviously I got to know you when you came over for the trial in 2018. But take me through what you were doing before you decided to take on a post office. I think that was back in 2005, 2006, wasn't it?
2006, we took on the post office. Yeah, I was working as an accounts clerk or credit controller for a cooking oil company. I was there maybe 4 years. And this opportunity came up. And I heard about the shop got up for leasing. So I approached them, and we made the decision then that it would be better. We always wanted something for ourselves. So we contacted the owners, and we negotiated and went from there.
And this was Kalita branch?
Kalita, yeah.
And that was where you grew up? You knew that town very well?
Yeah, so just a wee village. I would have went to that post office with my granny on a Thursday. She would always go down after pension. And there's a lot of history in that post office, like, for the family.
But what was the nature of the property? What was the deal? Because you got the shop, you got the counter, you got a property attached, didn't you?
Yeah, I had the shop, the post office. There was a house attached to it, and there was four stores. So it was a big property.
Four separate individual retail units?
There was three stores across the front and one basement. So there was a lot of potential there.
Right.
So we agreed a lease for 2 years, but we also agreed a price for buying it after the 2 years if we wanted to.
Got you.
So
how much was the total investment then? How much did you put into this?
Well, the asking price was $225,000.
Uh-huh.
At that stage.
And so you took that on with the mortgage, was it?
We leased it for 2 years, and then we took a buy-to-let mortgage on the house, and then we took a repayment mortgage on the shop and stores.
And when you say we, you mean you and your husband Darius, do you? Sorry, did you hear that, Deirdre?
No, I didn't.
Sorry.
You're froze.
Oh, forgive me. When you say we, it's you and your husband Darius who took this
yeah.
on.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had a young family, you had Sean and Gemma, am I right in thinking, yeah. already at that stage?
We did, yeah.
But they were obviously quite small, I would have
thought. What age there? Gemma's 29 and Sean's 27 now. So that was, what, 12 years
ago? Okay, so they would say they were teenagers.
Yeah.
Right. But you put a lot of risk into this project then.
It was supposed to be our retirement.
Uh-huh.
It's supposed to give us the freedom to take Sean to do his football, take Gemma wherever she wanted to go.
Got you.
You know, just to have time with the children.
But you'd essentially put all your financial eggs in that basket.
Oh,
and of course, this was right in the centre of the community that you knew and grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And you were presumably very visible. What was the job like when it was going well?
It was great. Yeah, it was really good. I loved meeting the people and chatting and... But a banter. Darius was the same. He was always, he loved the banter about football and stuff in the mornings.
And the post, I mean, I heard you say in the inquiry that you got no training whatsoever. You were trained up by the outgoing sub-postmaster. But you found a way of making it work. And for 4 years, it was going in the right direction because you were obviously getting by and establishing yourselves in the centre of the community.
Yeah.
What's Kalita like? I mean, I remember you've spoken a few times about that you're on the edge of quite a remote part of Northern Ireland. Can you just describe it for someone who's never been there?
It is approximately 3 mile from County Donegal, Perigo in County Donegal. It's West Tyrone.
What's the landscape like? How many people live in Kalita for a start?
You're only maybe a few hundred.
Really? So everyone knows everyone.
Exactly, yeah.
Which has benefits and disadvantages, I imagine.
Exactly.
So beyond to the west of Kalita, what have you got?
Well, you're just on the Donegal border, right round. The nearest town would be Castledeirg. And then further up the other way would be Enniskillen in County Fermanagh.
So quiet, rural, and
it's all rural.
It's getting into borders territory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. The day it all went wrong, I've heard so many postmasters talk about their individual experiences, and many people had growing problems that they tried to deal with or ended up just ignoring. It happened so suddenly with you, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Just take me through the day it all happened.
Can I do it? No, just on that week.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
On the Monday.
You can talk about what you like, did.
On the Monday, I would have done the outreach Monday and Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. It's worth saying you had two outreach units, didn't you? So
yeah.
This was what are outreach units again? Outreach. Assume that no one knows what that is.
You take your post office computer and a bag of case of money to rural areas that. What it previously had post offices, but then they were closed down with the program, network program. So I took on two. I was asked in 2009. I should have known at that stage because the area manager that asked me says that nobody couldn't get anybody else to do it.
Did he say why?
He says something about nobody else wants to do it, and would you help us out, pull us out of a jam? And I went, I no bother. That's just me.
So essentially it's like having a sort of mobile library. You were a mobile
That's
post
exactly,
office.
Yeah.
And you just went out with a bag of money and a laptop. And this was the laptop running the Horizon IT system?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a portable version of the IT system.
Yeah.
And
so then it was a very rural areas, and the first one on the Monday isn't too bad. It's in a shop, but the second one you need to go through really rural, no network areas.
Right.
So
when you say no network, no mobile phone signal.
No. So well, you're carrying a case of money.
How much money at times were we talking about?
Well, it depends if anybody had been making a lodgement. If somebody had made a lodgement, you would have been over whatever your limit was. I can't even remember, Nick, at this stage, so long ago, what the limit was.
So if someone deposited cash with you, you could be carrying tens of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, you could have been coming back.
On your own, in a car?
Yeah. And I was worried at one stage that it was being followed. So I phoned the police sergeant in Castledare, and he said patrol out. So I phoned them when I got back to Killader, the helpline, and what I was told was you've got a panic alarm button, press it, but the panic alarm button works on network.
So you had a panic alarm that the post office gave you, but it relied on a mobile phone signal, which you didn't have when you were out.
Yeah.
God.
So
what did that do for your peace of mind?
Exactly. One alert time as well that there was two fell because Killader's so rural and so small, you always know if there's a stranger on the street. So there's two men standing on the street and there were books or whatever, so I went out to them and they were looking at the shop in the post office. I said to them, I says, what are you up to? He says, oh, we're just getting coordinates for a helicopter. And Darius came out then. He says, a patrol car wouldn't reach here as quick as a helicopter would, if need be. And I went, what? He says, if anything happened here at the post office, a patrol car would be, or a helicopter would be faster than a patrol car to get here.
So these guys were from where?
Post office or security, I don't know where they're from, but that's what they were doing.
They didn't bother informing you they were coming?
No.
So you're painting a picture of quite a tightly knit community that you knew very, very well, having grown up there, and you were at the centre of that community. You were doing outreach work as part of your job into even more rural communities.
Yeah.
And like most rural post offices, you were potentially a target for people who might be interested in the amount of cash that you were either carrying or might be in your safe. Did you ever have any event like that? Did anything ever happen to you?
No, thank goodness. The shop was robbed, or the commandant tried to take the safe one night, but the alarm, the cameras, they had to give up just.
And that scared them off, did it?
Yeah.
But you were always conscious of the fact always that you conscious. Were a potential
The only thing, yeah, target. Because at that stage, over here, it was known as tiger kidnappings were happening.
I heard you talk about this in the inquiry. What's a tiger kidnap?
That they would take a member of your family hostage and they would send you to get the money in the post office.
And when you say they, who is this? Paramilitary organisation?
Paramilitaries,
Right, so there was a spate of that. And
there was a spate for a while, yeah.
Okay.
But so the fear was on. We put an alarm in the house and we were living in fear, to be honest. No, in hindsight, we were living in fear.
Yeah. But then, it just felt like vigilance at the time, did it?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay.
But Monday, this is in June
2010.
Yeah, I did the two outreach on the Monday and Tuesday. And the audit was on the Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So I landed up at the shop for about 20 past 8, I think, around that. And I just knew there was a strange car outside the shop. You always know every car that would be on the street in the mornings.
Wow.
So the registrations know. And I didn't get out of the car until somebody else, some of the locals, would came along, you know, for their paper. And they would have helped me out with the papers in the morning. So when I got out and walked over, the man got out and he came over and said he was from post office there to do an audit. I went, I no bother. So I opened up and went down and set the safe. I can't even remember the time delay on the safe. And then they put up a sign and I let him tear on.
So the sign said audit in progress, post office. So you couldn't actually run the system while the audit was going on. So basically you were closed for the morning while he did the audit.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
About 9 o'clock, we had somebody coming in to work, because I would always have been doing the balancing on a Wednesday. So it was let she would come in and help. She would do the shop while I'd done the balancing. So she came in at 9 and I went up to the wee office and I was just looking at paperwork, and the man came in about 9:30 and he says, Deirdre, he says, there's a discrepancy. And I did say a few choice words and I says, no, I definitely can't. I says, can I go and check it? He says, no, I can't, you can't. So he went back up and I went up after him walking up, but I didn't get in to check it. So I come back up and I phoned Darius.
Did he tell you the amount that you were out by?
Not at that stage. I don't think it was at that stage. It was, I phoned Darius and I went back out and I went up to the wee counter or the wee glass thing and I said to him, I says, how much are we chatting? And he was at the calculator and he says, 16,592. £16,592. Now, not a hope in hell. I says, can't be.
Had you had anything like that happen before?
I had shortages, Nick, but I always put it down to somebody counting the lotto wrong, counting cash wrong. You know, I'd always put it in. No, it wasn't major.
So what are we talking, 50 quid,
100 quid? Maybe £100.
Right.
You know, it wasn't major.
Not £16,000?
No, £16,592. So that was okay.
So when you hear that figure, how do you react? You just refuse to accept it?
I laughed at him. I did laugh. I thought he was... I didn't know what to think. So then he says, I'm going to have to phone somebody, blah blah blah. I think he said Brian Trotter, I'm not sure.
Who was Brian Trotter? Was he an area manager?
Contracts manager? I don't know.
Contracts manager.
Something like that there, anyway. And he says, I'm going to have to suspend you. So at this stage, I was waiting on Darius up, and I was standing in the shop on my own, and the employee, like, knowing there was something going on, and I didn't want to say anything because they would know there was something up, and then there's customers coming into the shop, and so I went back into the wee office again, out of the way, until Darius came up, and I said to Darius, I don't know what's going on. Like, I was just, I don't know. I couldn't believe, didn't know what was going on. We didn't know. In that short space of time, we didn't know how our life was going to go on.
Yeah.
Been told that this here, and you were being suspended, and this was happening. What's going on here?
What were the implications? So immediately the post office counter had to be shut down.
Yeah. They,
and then what happened to
they
you?
They took the keys. They took the keys. And
so you couldn't get into the counter?
No, because it's like a wee box at the back of the shop.
Yeah.
And there's only one key. So it was all a bunch of keys. So he took them and that was it.
So imagine the first thing that happens is this goes around the village like wildfire.
Yep. Post office is closed.
Postmistress suspended.
Yeah. So we went for a wee drive, myself and our S-stick, we went for a drive round, just around the roads, wee country roads.
What was he saying to you?
Darius?
Yeah.
He was quiet for a while. He says, "Diddy, what's happened?" I says, "Darius, I don't know." And then we started thinking of, we're trying to maybe blame, there was another employee would have been in there, but I said, no, definitely not. We were trying to make sense of what was happening or what had happened. So we come back to the shop and the employee was still there. She was there at 2 o'clock, I think. And as I just left at that stage, and Darius, poor Darius, had to stay and deal with it all. Your man was there until about 4 o'clock. So he done what he had to do and he locked up. 4 o'clock, away he went. And then all the letters started coming about going to see fraud investigator, going to this meeting, going to this, will you let your premises out to a temporary sub-postmaster? And I thought, what is going on here? So...
Did you get a temp in?
They put somebody in.
You got a temp in, and then you had to deal with the disciplinary process and the investigation process. What was the first thing that happened with regard to that?
First meeting, I think, was in Belfast, but I'm not 100% sure. That was sort of a time when I was on tablets to keep me calm down.
Really? Did you go downhill very quickly?
So
you had to get prescribed medication just to stay calm?
Yeah.
How quickly did this happen then?
And
what was it? What was eating away at you? What was getting at you?
I think it's just people thinking that I stole money.
Right.
I think that was basically it. So we went to Belfast to a meeting.
Just before you get to the meeting, just describe that feeling, because some people haven't been in a small community and won't know what it's like to be the centre of suspicion and how acutely you can feel that. Just tell us what it was that was and how it manifested itself, how it stopped you from functioning.
I kept thinking of everybody would have been coming up to the shop and they would be chatting about me and thinking that I'd done it and me knowing that I'd done nothing wrong, but I couldn't speak to them because I didn't know what was going to be said by post office. My mind was going around in circles. I just did not know what to think, how to think about it, how to make any logical sense out of it.
Did anyone say anything to your face?
No. No, there was a few people said, "Didi, get your arse back up at that shop. You've done nothing wrong." So there was a few, but then I heard people had said stuff that came back to me, and I just knew, like, a small village, they're going to be chatting about you anyway.
So the people that supported you came and supported you to your face, but you heard about other people doing a whispering campaign behind your back.
That's exactly it, whispering campaign.
And did that just ate away your self-confidence, did it?
Yeah. I was the day we got married, the priest that day said that I was very vivacious. After that day, I had no confidence. I had nothing. I was a completely different woman. I know that myself.
So before you even went to your first interview, you were already on medication to try and keep you calm. What was that first interview like, and who was it with?
It was... I know there was an NFSP man from County Down there with me.
National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, which I think at the time was the Postmasters' official union, wasn't it?
Apparently, yeah.
Did Darius come along?
Darius was there, but he wasn't allowed to go up the stairs. The only thing I remember about that meeting is walking up the stairs. I don't remember being up the stairs or anything else. But I do remember him, the man chatting downstairs, the Federation man to Darius, and saying, just tell him you done it.
What, tell him you took the money? Mm-hmm. What was his thinking for saying that?
I don't know.
Now, what was the impression you got then?
Well, I was in cuckoo land anyway, with the tablets, medication. It was Darius, I think he said not a hope. I don't know. That day's a complete blur. I think I was a week after it happened. So it was still very raw.
Gosh. So you've gone downhill that rapidly. You'd had your first interview with an NFSP rep had been on your side but said you should admit it. But you can't remember what the post office were asking you at that interview.
No, I don't. It's like the day I took my first epilepsy seizure. I don't remember that day. So that day with that federation or that in Belfast, I don't remember that day either.
But your position was, I haven't done anything dishonest.
I've done nothing wrong. If I've made a mistake, tell me. Let me know where. Show me. But then that was the first meeting. That was next week. But even on the Wednesday of the following week, the auditor, so-called auditor, came out and was doing the monthly balance.
Right, so this is the guy who suspended you. He came back.
Yeah. He came back the following week and Darius was in the shop. It wasn't me. And he went up and he came up to Darius midway through whatever he was doing and he had notes in his hand, money. And he said, Darius, he says, there's £1,000 I found in the safe that I didn't see last week. So that reduced my shortfall to £15,592.
Which kind of filled you with a great deal of confidence.
Correct. It's not a big safe. It was a small safe and the money was all in there. I had no keys, nobody had any keys, only them.
So if he can miscount more than 5% of the discrepancy in cash, who knows what else he might have been miscounting on the system.
Yeah.
So tell me about the second interview that you had.
Second interview. That was with the fraud investigator, Suzanne Wonders. Now, that was held in OMA and a Royal Mail office. Myself and Darius and the family solicitor at the time.
Did you abandon the NFSP guy by this stage?
Yeah.
So you had a solicitor.
Family solicitor. Like he wouldn't just deal through wills and stuff. He wasn't into anything big. So he came with us. We were done. Went up the steps and Suzanne Wonders come out and she says to Darius, you can't be in here. And Frog marched him out to the street. Let the solicitor stay, but put Darius out, marched him right out onto the street.
Did she say why he couldn't attend the interview?
No. So I went in. Solicitor sat. He was told he wasn't allowed to speak. He wasn't allowed to speak. He was just there to listen. So I went in and there was Suzanne Wonders.
Can you actually tell a solicitor that?
They did. So I went into the room. There was this, must have been 6'6" man. English accent. And he says, I just flew in this morning. He says, from London. And I thought to myself, what the hell's going on here?
Do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name, and he said that it was the interview's been recorded, but when we will look for the tape, it's not to be found.
So did they never send you your version of the recording?
No, they never gave me a copy.
They should have given you it there and then.
No.
Were you told you were being interviewed under caution?
I know we're being recorded, but I can't remember if he said caution or not.
So they didn't? Did they read you any rights or anything like that? Tell you what you were entitled to?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so, Nick.
How did the interview go?
That was rough. And it's one of those things that you take from different settings. And it was just one thing was, did you take the money for the paramilitaries? I see once that word was mentioned, the knees started to quake. Thinking, why are they bringing that up? Why are they bringing paramilitaries up? And this here?
People who don't live in Northern Ireland might not quite understand the significance of someone saying that during an interview. What was your concern? Why did you start to get worried when you just heard that.
Paramilitaries at that stage, like, I thought that it was, if I was saying anything about them, like, they could, my safety, my family's safety.
So by him even asking that question,
scared me. He says, if he's saying it, is there, Sam Munter saying it to some other postmasters, is this here what's going on? I was worried.
What might happen if word leaked that you were under investigation for giving or dealing with the paramilitaries over stolen money?
They would think that I was informing. They'd think... You just don't, paramilitaries, just that word just does scare you over here.
So by bringing up the idea he was potentially putting your family in danger.
He was threatening. It was threatening behaviour. Because he would have knew that would be brought up over here.
What do you think he was trying to do by raising the issue then?
I don't know.
I mean, you know, presume he didn't have a shred of evidence to put before you.
They had no evidence whatsoever for anything.
They didn't. Did they try and present you with anything and ask you to explain it?
No, I've seen nothing. They put it down that I couldn't count money, I think.
But on the specific issue of paramilitaries, he was just flying a kite, do you think? Or do you think, he was deliberately doing it to intimidate you?
He was deliberately doing it to intimidate me. I know that now, but at that time, it was just a lot of scaremongering. And it worked for me. If I had had Darius with me, I would have been a lot, felt, I don't know, more comfortable anyway.
So were you intimidated, frightened?
Of course I was. Oh, big time. Like, you have a 6'6" ex-policeman, apparently he was, asking you these questions, and you think, why is he over here? Why is he doing this? Why is he? Mine was going round in circles.
Other than raising the issue of the paramilitaries, what else did he ask you?
Where did the money go? I must have asked that 20 times.
Did you ever raise the issue of Horizon?
No. I says there has to be a mistake somewhere. I says show me where I went wrong. Show me where the mistake is. I says because I don't have the money. And I says you can have my bank statements. You can look at them. You can check anything. I says I didn't take the money.
How long did the interview last?
Felt like an hour. I don't know. I really don't know.
Did your solicitor stay quiet?
I had never any dealings with any legal or police or anything, so I didn't know to ask for a copy of the recording. I didn't know what questions to ask because it's a wee area and you don't expect things like this to happen. You don't know what to do in a situation like that.
What about your lawyer? What was he doing all the time?
Sitting and saying nothing.
What did he say afterwards?
He come out and we got into the car and he turned around to Darius and he says, Darius, can you get that money together? He says, you need to get that money together because that woman will never make it through.
So he was suggesting that he thought the post office might be about to prosecute you or alluding to that, or was that not on the table? I mean, I don't know.
They never even mentioned prosecuting or doing anything else. He just thought that no matter what, I wouldn't have been able to cope with anything.
Do you think he was intimidated?
Don't know. Never thought of that.
What happened next then?
So went home and Darius, I contacted Mum and Darius contacted his mother and Mum must have phoned my uncle and he come down the next day and he gave me a cheque for a good bulk of the difference. I think it was 8,500 and then an aunt gave me money, Darius' mother and my mother. They all pitched in to give us money. we got the check sent away, and I wrote the check and I sent a letter asking to investigate where I had made the mistake or where the money disappeared to, and I'm still waiting on an answer.
So the discrepancy had gone down to 15,592 because
yeah.
The auditor had found this extra £1,000 he'd mm-hmm. failed to count the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You had a demand for that money, which yeah. you settled by borrowing off family.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked, when you sent in that check, tell me why, tell me where this discrepancy's come from, tell me yeah. where I'm from. And they never responded.
Nope.
Once the money had been taken off you by the post office, did you get your post office back?
No. My contract was cancelled and was it July or August? I can't remember. Can't remember the dates.
That same year?
Yeah.
So within a month, you've gone from running a successful post office, happy in your job, having done yeah. it for 4 years, building a growing business, to being suspended, investigated on suspicion of
mm-hmm.
stealing £15,000, losing your mental health, and then losing your job at the end of it without being given a reason.
I can't remember the dates, but it was about maybe a couple of months later, like August, September, maybe September, I'm not sure.
But you just got a letter saying, see ya. I mean, but you'd paid the money back.
Uh-huh.
You'd paid the money, you'd handed the money in.
I got a letter from them saying, we have concluded our investigations and no criminal proceedings will be instigated against you. So, bye-bye.
Was that the first time the issue of criminal proceedings was raised?
Mm-hmm. And that scared me. That was a low point for me, mentally. Because being naive, I knew I'd done nothing wrong. But I didn't even think that be criminal prosecutions. It wasn't even on my radar because I'd done nothing.
And where were you in your life at that stage? I know you've spoken about sort of being too frightened to go out of the house or too worried about what people would think to leave the house.
I was that day that I got that letter, I was in the kitchen and it was that evening. I opened it and Darius was away doing football coaching and I was in the house on my own, don't know where the kids were. And I remember opening and thinking, I didn't realise it was, no, this was so, what could have happened? And I was at a low ebb, low time that night. I thought, what's the point in us here? But for some reason, a friend of mine just landed, came to the door, and she saved me that night.
Gone.
So she did. That was my lowest point.
It's sometimes very hard for people who know nothing about this scandal to try and put themselves in your shoes, because the mere threat of being such a visible person in a community, in such a tiny community as yours,
mm-hmm.
when that's taken away from you, it's really quite hard for people to kind of understand just how visible and just how trusted you were. And then suddenly this sort of shroud of suspicion mm-hmm. that falls upon you and how that really affects the individual, especially given that it happened to you so quickly. Can you try and explain that at all? What's that like, that feeling? Even though you know you've done nothing wrong, even though in your case you weren't criminally prosecuted, even though so many people were, you'd lost your job, a very visible job in the centre of the community.
It was like a roller coaster. We didn't know what was going to happen as a family, if we're going to, money wise. All these things kept just going over and over in my head, and I was overthinking probably. But we were put in a situation that we couldn't control, it was out of our control. We knew people were chatting about us. We knew some were pitying us.
Some of what, sorry?
Pity in us.
Oh, sorry.
And you think, don't want pity. You know, it's just a funny, funny sense of how you do feel. I know I didn't, I wouldn't go down the town. I never went out of the house. I stopped going to Mass. And then...
Why was that? You just couldn't bear to be seen in church?
No, just... And even with me taking medication, I was sleeping most of the time. And even thought I was sick. In hindsight, I thought I was sick. Like, I was taking palpitations, but it was all stress. Taking palpitations, and I was going to get checked out, and there was nothing wrong with me. But in my head, I thought I was sick.
How were Darius and the kids coping?
Well, Darius, he was my rock. So he was, he still is.
Sorry, Deirdre, I'm so sorry. After I asked you that question, either you or I froze. Would you mind just starting answering that question again?
Darius was my rock. He still is. Gemma was very strong. Very strong. Sean was strong to a certain extent. But it took its toll on him and his mental health. His anxiety, he suffers with anxiety and depression now. Even lately, it's come back on him again.
You forget, don't you, how kids pick up so quickly.
He was
on a situation.
Yeah, he was the one that saw me in my first epilepsy seizure, and I didn't recognise him, and it still haunts him. You know, four of us would be a very close family. We always, there's no secrets, sort of. So it hit him hard now.
How did Darius cope? I mean, did he start self-medicating? Did he get stressed? No. Did he get angry? Did he lash out at people?
We started drinking. We did, in the house, in the evenings. It was... At night time, we did drink a lot. But... We got through it. His blood pressure... It's now, years later, it's taken its toll on him. He's got high blood pressure. But we got through it. We got through it as a family. Our marriage got through it. And that's...
Which is a wonderful testament to you both and to you as a family. I often wonder how, at the time, you don't get angry as well about the situation that you're in. Did you find that anger welling up either within you or within him or within the kids even? Because the kids can get angry at a situation that they don't understand.
We would have been mixed emotions. Sometimes we were angry, but we didn't know who we were angry at. Only post office. We never blamed each other. Which was good. Blamed each other. You know, sometimes you'd just think, ugh, just rouse. We never rowed.
But did you see any way out of it? Did you see anyone who could help or any?
No.
And this got serious, didn't you? Because because of what happened in the post office, you lost trade in the shop, and it went financially quite seriously downhill, didn't it?
Yeah, we did.
Which obviously adds to the stress.
With the we lost the the post office salary, that was paying our mortgage each month for the house. So we were worried about keeping our house. We were worried about having to move. Where would we move to? What would we do? We just didn't know what the future held for us. And the kids picked up on all that.
You've got no financial security, you don't have any other kind of security, do you?
Correct, yeah.
Did it feel like a lifeline when you made contact with the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance?
That was the best phone call I ever made.
Because that put you in contact with other people who'd been in a similar situation. Had you come across anyone else before then who was in a similar position?
No.
So what was it like finding out that there were other people who'd been through something almost exactly the same?
Such a weight lifted. Just knowing that I wasn't on my own. I wasn't the only one. It was good. It was a good phone call to make.
And then you had... So after the mediation scheme collapsed in 2014, 2015, and you withdrew before you got to mediation, there was a long period, wasn't there, before the court case came around. What were you doing as a family? Were you just trying to make ends meet?
I was in benefits. Darius was still, he was still in the shop. We kept the shop going as long as possible, and then just bankruptcy, just the wholesaler made us bankrupt. So we tried to do an IVA.
Yeah, insolvency voluntary agreement.
But the creditors wouldn't accept it, so there was no other option then. And we even got a bill for doing up the IVA for £3,000.
Oh.
Which went into bankruptcy.
Right. so your heads were below water, financially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And we got keeping our house because the house was in negative equity.
Well, so it had value to anyone to take off you?
Yeah. So that was a good thing.
Did you need any persuading to join the court case? Because you must have realised it was going to require a certain amount of mental resilience, and it was also going to potentially require you sort of volunteering a lot of information for potentially nothing.
We sat down, four of us sat down, and we discussed it. And I spoke to my mother, and Darius spoke to his mother.
Were you still in debt to them at that time?
Oh, we still are. We still are. We said this is what we want to do, and they're happy. They were happy for us to go with it. Like any decision, I never made it on my own. I made it with Darius and the two kids.
So you weighed it all up together and decided it was worth going into. Mm. And then, of course, the trial started. Presumably by that stage, you were in contact. Were you in regular contact with other members of the JFSA, or was it a bit more sporadic than that?
First time I got chatting to somebody from the JFSA after Alan was Joe Hamilton. I had done a radio programme. I think you'd done it with me, with Stephen Nolan.
Yes.
And you messaged me that evening or something. You messaged me. And you said that you thought Joe Hamilton was the next village to me. And asked, could you pass my number on to her? And she came down to me the next day and we spoke for a couple of hours.
That's right. Was she visiting friends in Northern Ireland?
She was over for her in-laws, David's brother. There's a funeral or something.
Right. And had she heard the broadcast or had I just...
That's what it was. She heard it coming down. She was on her way from the airport. And she called down on me. And that was a great get chatting there.
Yeah, because she likes to chat, doesn't she? Mm. And I'm sure you do as well. She was a good person to be in contact with. If people don't know who Jo Hamilton is, she is one of the mainstay campaigners of the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance. And she put herself out there for years and years and years to try and get justice for the campaigners involved. And she is, I think she's still very well respected within the group. She's very good at keeping people in contact and keeping people.
She's another figure in the group.
So that comes up to the point at which we met. And I must say, you came over as a family, didn't you? So I met you and I met Darius and I met Sean and I met Gemma. And it was, we had a couple of, because I think you came over twice in the end. Was it for the two trials? I can't remember whether you came over for the first or second trial.
The second trial was the 17th of March, and that was a Monday. And on the Thursday, the judge, the application to get him recused.
Right. So you had one of the drier days, and then you had one of the more eventful weeks in the second trial. Which, at the time, it was all in the thick of it, and you didn't really know what was going on. But it's part of me was quite glad that at least you got to see a bit of drama. And you met Ron Warmington, I think, on that second occasion.
Ron Warmington was He recommended me for mediation. I met, had been talking to him.
Oh, so you'd known him for a while? Okay. So you must have, because I mean, when I met you, your spirits were up. I mean, this wasn't meant to have been a depressing and upsetting conversation, Deirdre, and I'm sorry to rake over old ground. But when I met you, you presented a very strong face to the world, and Darius was a very confident man, and the kids, you know, were with you and they were supporting you. Was that just because that was the face you were setting to the world, or did you think, well, look, things are moving now. We've got this massive multi-million-pound high court case going on. You know, people are starting to listen to us.
I think it's the fact that we'd got that far, and yes, somebody was listening to us, finally. And I was hoping that somebody would be held accountable at that stage. You know, that was always, and within the group, GFSA group, that's all they want is accountability of what they put us through.
Yeah. So the end of the trial, the settlement agreement, that felt like very good news, but it felt like it for about 5 minutes until the sort of realization of what the implications were. And what I keep having to remind, I think not myself, because I know how important that High Court litigation was, but everything that has happened in the 2 years since that litigation concluded has come as a direct result of that litigation.
Yes.
So the convictions wouldn't have been quashed if the litigation hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. The compensation for people outside the scheme wouldn't have been set up. That wouldn't have then triggered the Court of Appeal stuff, which led to the statutory inquiry being set up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So although, I mean, you won. That was the bottom line. You won. But you in particular, you haven't seen a fraction of the money that you should have received as a result of winning that litigation. Yeah. And you still haven't. So what's it been, and that's because of the bankruptcy. So what's it been like watching the other compensation schemes being set up? So you had people who weren't part of the trial, potentially with a route to getting more compensation than you would get. People getting their convictions quashed and a huge pot of money being opened up for them. And then the government slowly coming around to the idea that, oh, actually, it would be the right and fair thing to do to compensate properly the 555 civil litigants. Just explain to me that what it's been like for you personally, because you had a relapse, didn't you, pretty much straight after the litigation came to an end.
2022.
Or was it a year afterwards?
It was a year after.
It was a year after. So take me through then the last 2.5 years. What's it been like?
The settlement,
experiencing it all.
Settlement. The bankruptcy got 49% of my settlement in 2000. When was that? 20.
And that was only a fraction of what the settlement was because of the amount that had already gone in legal and success fees.
Yeah. At that stage, I just thought, well, that's it. I accepted it. I was disheartened that the bankruptcy took 49%, but it was the only way I could get into the litigation. So,
did you mind me asking how much you actually got then in your pocket at the end of that settlement?
I think it was about 11,000.
Oh, so it wasn't even as much as you'd handed over to the post office in the first instance?
No. No.
And I would imagine you must be hundreds of thousands of pounds away from where you would be had you continued to run a successful business from 2010 onwards.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. So that was that. I can't even remember the last 2 years. I've just been working. After the December 19 trial or judgment, December 19, I went back to work. And the cooking oil company that I was in previous to the shop.
How did that come about?
The MD contacted me and just sent me a lovely message, and which I'll never forget, and I still have it. And he says, I didn't know you were going through all this, blah, blah, blah. And then maybe a few months later, he messaged me to see how to be, was it working or whatever. And he says, there's a job if you want to put on a CV in the company. So that's what I did. I've done up a CV. I hadn't done one in many years. I'd done up a CV and handed it in and went for an interview and I got the job. So I was on there.
So he didn't know anything that you'd been going through till it hit the news as a result of the settlement.
Yeah.
And saw that you were one of those people involved.
Yeah.
And he reached out to you and said,
yeah,
come back and work for me.
Well, that was a few months later, like. But
What did that do for your self-confidence?
Oh, that was brilliant. That gave me a real boost. Real boost. So that's what I did. And I worked there until last year. I took a relapse in January last year. I came to a head that I needed help.
What was the sticking point? What was not right?
I think I'd never really spoke to anybody about what happened to me. About how I felt. You know, I was always brushing over it.
Did you feel a responsibility to your family as well to sort of keep going?
Yeah. You know, and it just came to head and I had to get help. So I actually went to, it was a personal coach. And they go coaching and she was absolutely amazing. She was really good. She just made me think things in a different light.
Okay.
No, not go back in history, just think about different ways of thinking things, thinking about things. And it really did help me. So then I was paranoid. Everything was just going through my head at that stage. And I knew I needed a change of jobs as well. So I changed jobs in July last year.
And it's really interesting because things on the face of it, and you talk to people who don't know anything about this scandal and they go, oh, well, they all got their convictions quashed and they've all got compensation. And you know, people don't realise the nuances of what's been happening to individuals. How were you feeling about the fact that the story had come out? I mean, that was the main thing. The story had come out. People were getting their convictions quashed. Your personal situation, financial situation, had not been resolved. But I'm really surprised that your mental health was still being battered.
Yeah, well,
because it sounds on the face of it like everything should be good news. So what was it? Was it just the cumulative effect of the previous years?
Yeah, and the pressure of having to work 40 hours a week constantly and not seeing any difference for it. You know, because you get into debt very easily. But then last year, getting there again. It's always going to drag up at some stage. There's going to be something that's going to trigger bad memories, make you think of things differently, and thinking, well, if this hadn't happened to me, I would be this. Me personally now thinking, I should be in a position now that I can watch my grandson. You know, spend time with him.
How old are you now?
I'm 53 next week. So.
What triggers you then? What sets you off? What are the moments or the things that trigger a bad memory or a bad experience?
Like the last week, that was a bad saying that it wasn't, had me hopes all built up from March when Paul's calling said about, you know, we're getting an interim payment and blah blah blah. So that's 6 months now. And it's supposed to be sorted out within weeks. It'll be sooner rather than later, was the statement.
We ought to explain this. So after, again, Alan Bates and the JFSA campaigned relentlessly to get proper compensation for the civil litigants, the government finally announced in March that actually, after all, yes, you would get ex gratia payments, which should go towards putting you back in the same financial position you would have been had you not fallen foul of Horizon and the post office's punitive methods. And at the same time Scully made that announcement, he also announced that 19.5 million quid would be made available for interim compensation, and that would be parcelled up and doled out to all of the civil litigants. And yet, as you say, here you are 6 months down the line not having received a penny for that. Mm-hmm. And last week it sort of was made public that that was because there are many cases, not just yours, who are bankrupt and insolvent, and the government is finding it hard to work out a way of giving you the cash. And I think you messaged me saying, look, have you heard about this? And then we spoke on the phone and you were very down. You were just so what is it? Is it just feeling something last like that will trigger and it feels like a kick in the teeth? Or
it was a roller coaster last week. Was 1 minute you're not getting an interim payment, next minute you might be getting an interim payment, you will get an interim payment, then you know, so I didn't know what way. I still don't know what way to think. Am I supposed to be happy or sad, or what way am I supposed to be?
You do get the sense that people, I mean, I don't know, because obviously I haven't been in that situation, but you wonder whether people are being played with or toyed with, or it must feel like you're being toyed with by either uncaring individuals or the, you know, or the gods or whatever. It must feel quite desperate at times. Mm. Just tell me what it was like giving evidence to the statutory inquiry, because I've been incredibly moved by the experiences that have been recorded during the human impact statements at the inquiry and by the witness statements as well, which lay bare exactly what has happened to so many people in a way that I think is more or less unique. You know, you try and tell so many people's stories over the years, but to see so many of them in a format which actually brings home quite how appalling the whole thing has been. What was it like to actually go through that process of giving evidence yourself?
That was a hard day. That was a really hard day. Sir Wynne listened. He was interested and he asked questions. And I thought, this is brilliant. It was hard for me personally to do that evidence.
Because why was that? Because I've interviewed you before and you've been interviewed on the radio and you did seem to find it hard.
I don't know. I thought it was the end. This was closure. I did think doing that inquiry would be closure for me, but obviously it's not going to be.
What would closure look like? Because accountability was the one thing that you mentioned at the top of your list when Sir Wynne asked you what you wanted.
I want that the fraud investigator and that man who flew in from London. I want him to answer who gave the order to ask those questions, to treat people like the way they do. Because I know over in Northern Ireland, the same name crops up all the time.
Who's that?
That's of Suzanne Winters, the fraud investigator.
Oh, right. Who did your interview?
Yeah. Her name pops up in a lot of cases that I've been talking to people here in Northern Ireland since the inquiry. But no, somebody has to answer for what... Who gave the orders? Who knew what was going on? Obviously, they all knew, but just covered it up from the very top.
I think this is the thing. There's going to be what looks like a reasonably forensic inquiry. Mm. And you know it will be a massive bottom-protecting exercise for everyone who knew what they knew. And I think even if Sir Wynne's report is as damning as you might expect it to be, it's not going to make up for the lost years, is it? And the lost money and the lost opportunities that so many people have suffered.
About 12, 13 years of my life gone. So, 12 years. Going on to the 13. And like Gemma and Sean's life, they saw me going through hell and they shouldn't have to. Your children shouldn't have to see you going through this.
Has any good come out of this at all for you, Deirdre? Is there anything that you can point at and go, well, this has been my life at least I've got this, or I mean, it's the way it's happened to you. It's, I appreciate that's a hard thing to even contemplate, but you kind of are where you are, aren't you?
You have to deal with the hand you're dealt.
I mean, you've got a lovely family. I can vouch for that. Are all enormously good company. Mm. And I suppose you've met some very special people, but
yeah,
you know, there's no reason why they should have, why you should have had to meet them, and why you've been
put
in that environment.
Just knowing that I'm not on my own, that was the biggest thing. And knowing that Sir One is listening and taking heed. First time anybody listened. Well, Judge Fraser. He was amazing too.
What would you say to anyone listening to this who's perhaps not been in a situation that you've been in, where you've had your livelihood taken away from you in a wholly unjust way, and you haven't been able to do anything about it? In fact, you were completely ignored when you tried to say that you'd done nothing wrong and try to explain that you'd done nothing wrong. I mean, it can happen, can't it? It can happen to people who are victims of miscarriages of justice in other walks of life like. And, you know, even though you weren't prosecuted, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind this qualifies as a miscarriage of justice for what happened to you. There's nothing just about what happened to you. How would you try and describe it to people who really can't, who've never been in that situation before?
Just count your blessings that you don't be. You wouldn't wish this on your worst enemy.
That was Deirdre Connolly, former Kalita sub-postmaster, one of the 555, and still waiting for any decent compensation for what happened to her.
It was also Deirdre's birthday and her and Darius's wedding anniversary this week. So happy birthday, Deirdre, and happy anniversary to you both.
So thank you for listening to another podcast. If you want to read more about our work and what we've been doing, you can sign up to my Substack, which is Rebecca Thompson's newsletter. You just have to Google it. Another Substack recommendation I have is for Professor Richard Moorhead's newsletter. He's a professor of legal ethics at Exeter University, and he has written a colossal 7 blog posts on the recent Swift review,
which was unearthed.
Yeah, it really is. It takes some getting through, but it's really worth it.
Yeah, the Swift review was the document that was unearthed through a Freedom of Information request by Eleanor Shake in August, which I published on postofficescandal.uk. And, I mean, it's a very significant document, not least because it suggests to the Post Office that they are dealing with miscarriages of justice, which they still did not admit until gone 2019. And it was withheld. The Post Office chairman commissioned the review and then withheld it from the Post Office board. So there are all sorts of legal, ethical considerations about the review, what it says, the way it says it, etc. And yes, Professor Richard Moorhead has rather gone to town on it.
Yeah, the whole thing is quite confusing. And he kind of brings a bit of, I guess, understanding to the whole thing, which is extremely helpful. The other thing which I quickly wanted to mention was I spoke to David Enright this morning, who's one of the lawyers for sub-postmasters at the inquiry. He mentioned that he has written a letter to Bayes about the issues with compensation that Deirdre was talking about, which has been sent to all of his clients. He's not able to send this letter to us or share it with us, but we were hoping that potentially somebody might have a copy that they would be happy to share with us anonymously. Please, thank you.
Yes, obviously anyone sending us anything, it will be treated in the absolute strictest confidence, so it can be done so anonymously. Yeah, that's the way often these documents find their way into the public domain, so that would be great to see the contents of the letter sent to Bayes, unless you're in the government and you want to leak it from the government end as well, which is also perfectly legitimate.
Nick, have you got anything else you want to talk about?
I'm doing a talk at my local library as part of National Libraries Week on writing the great Post Office scandal and my current project, which is Depp v. Heard, The Unreal Story. So if you want to come to Walton Library in Walton-on-Thames on Tuesday night at 5 o'clock, it costs £3 to cover the refreshments, and I will talk to you about the agony and mild satisfaction one can get from writing a book, and anything else that springs to mind about journalism. So, if you want to come along to that. And I'm also speaking, I'm being interviewed by Julian Warraker, who is one of my broadcasting heroes, at the Cuckfield Book Festival on Sunday the 9th. So the Walton Library is Tuesday the 4th of October, and the Cuckfield Book Festival is Sunday the 9th of October at 2 o'clock. Just Google Cuckfield Book Festival and I'm sure you'll be able to find it. I think that's a bit more than £3. I think that's £12 for the session. But I'm looking forward to those two. Those are the two things that I've got that are coming up. What are immediate, Rebecca?
Well, thank you very much for listening to episode 12 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. This podcast is written, produced, paid for and edited by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace. But we are supported with wisdom and expertise by Whistledown Productions.
And I am in the Whistledown studios right now, which is why I sound amazing.
We'll be back with more soon, including an interview with the writer and producer of a play about the post office scandal called False Accounts.
See you next time.
Bye.